Excellent. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
And today, for our special guest, we have Ceridium.
Gapla! Hello, everyone. Yay. Nice to be here.
And you will know him from the Gates of Stovacor audio drama and the G&T podcast. You'll also know him from the next Tales from the DMZ episode, if I ever finish editing it.
Someday.
One day out there. But today, we are continuing our Star Trek film analyzing series with Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Aw, yeah.
And I'm under political pressure in the chat room to mention that I reviewed this episode way back in episode 12. I should say I reviewed this movie way back in episode 12. But that basically is so long ago, I don't think it ever actually happened. So I think we're good.
And I am obligated now, though, but now we're here, so we can review it gooder more so.
Yeah, that's true. Nobody was here before, so, you know,
yeah,
it'll be good.
Yeah.
Episode 12, picks or it didn't happen.
Oh, dear. And now, of course, we are using TeamSpeak for the first time in a while, so if I mess up and forget to hit the talk to type button, it's not my fault. It's TeamSpeak's fault. You guys all remember that.
And if I'm a little laggy or I get cut off, that's my bad. I'm still getting used to the controls here.
One other little
announcement. I just don't have an excuse.
Yeah, you're just bad at it, sorry. No question. Now, another little announcement is to remind everybody that we do, in fact, have a Facebook group where I post controversial things about Star Trek that I hope you guys will all come and argue with me about.
Controversial? No. Say it ain't so.
I'm as shocked as you are.
Controversial might be giving myself too much credit on that one. But I hope that you will all come and argue with me about things like if this movie should have had Savick in it instead of Valeris, or if there should have been more or fewer Data Sherlock Holmes episodes.
Or, by request, you can argue with any other one of us also. Get, you know, multi-arguing going on there.
It's true. Sometimes Grace posts there, which confused me at first. I was like, wait, who is this? I didn't post this thing. And I was like, oh, right, I gave Grace admin privileges. That was my first mistake.
Yeah, Oren's forgotten he's not the king of all things Trek anymore.
Can I at least be, like, the duke of all things
no!
Trek?
No!
Can I have a dukedom? I want to be a duke. Come on, Grace.
I wouldn't know who wears the dukedom in this relationship.
Well, yeah, it's the Star Trek. We're all wearing the Star Trek miniskirt. I mean, those are standard issue.
Equal opportunity miniskirtage, really.
Speak for yourself. I am in
some
a Klingon.
Some of us just look better in it.
Klingons don't wear skirts. We wear kilts.
Yep.
All right. Tomato.
So technically, I think we were here to review a movie at some point, weren't we?
In theory, yeah.
Well, it's a good thing that I watched it.
Yeah, see,
yay.
This is... I keep accidentally... My talk to type button is the tilde key, and I keep filling my Word document with tildes. So hang on, give me a sec.
Control. I use right control. So
I actually came prepared this week. I watched the film.
This is actually one of the Star Trek movies that I've seen probably the most of any other Star Trek movie, so I'm on good footing this week.
Would you say it's one of your favorites then, if you've seen it?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. This is actually probably my favorite Star Trek movie, so I'm really excited.
Yeah, it is really good, and I'm sometimes hard-pressed to choose between this one and Wrath of Khan. Like, it will sometimes come down to which one I've seen more recently. It'll also depend on if I'm thinking more about the overall message of the film as opposed to some of its individual little nitpicks that I have. Because I really love the overall theme of this one, but it does have a couple of, like, minor problems that Wrath of Khan doesn't.
I just really love seeing the franchise get back to its sort of epic Shakespearean roots that we really got to see in Wrath of Khan and that really get brought back in this movie. And it just warms the nerdy cockles of my heart.
Wait, does this movie have Shakespeare in it? Are you kidding, Grace? I don't know what you're talking about here. Shakespeare in Star Trek VI? It's not like we had
a villain.
But
Shakespeare is so much better than the original Klingon.
Oh, well, obviously. Alright, so... Let's talk about the Shakespeare in this movie, actually, a little bit. I didn't have that on my show notes, but let's go ahead and talk about it. So, Grace obviously likes the Shakespeare. How do our two Klingons feel about it?
Tach, par, tach, be. No. Actually, I love it. It's very cool. I remember either the writer, the director, or the producers, they were kind of wondering about, are we putting too much Shakespeare into it? Because not just the direct references of, you know, quoting Hamlet and saying Shakespeare in the original Klingon. But there's other, throughout the movie, you know, there's Shakespeareisms, and they're thinking, are we putting too much into it? But I don't think they overdid it. I think it's just the right amount, and it is a theme, so I think it goes well with the theme.
It's the title and everything.
Right.
And it's interesting because it really, like, pushes the idea of the undiscovered country, hang on, into, like, a different area than it was in the original quote, right? Because the original quote, the undiscovered country, is from Hamlet, and he's talking about death. Whereas in this one, they're talking about the future. So it's like taking that quote and
both of which are the unexplored for them.
Well, and there's, when he says, the Chancellor Gorkon says to the undiscovered country, and to address the whole thing about the meaning, it originally meaning death, they don't say that specifically, but there's a, and you watch the scene, there's like a pause, like a pregnant pause, where they're like just like looking at him, and he's like, the future. So it kind of addresses it if you know what it is, you know, but I did like that too, that it's twisting on, you know, changing what the meaning was and going forward.
I really like that too, because I like how it kind of adds to the idea that the Klingons had this exposure to Shakespeare also. They just interpreted it very differently, maybe. And, like, they have their own cultural spin that they got out of it. And I just really like that idea of them having access to something that we consider as big and as part of our culture as Shakespeare, and, you know, just, what am I saying? Interpreting it differently.
Well, it brings up that saying where, you know, you put 10,000 monkeys with typewriters in a room, and in 10,000 years, one of them would have typed out Shakespeare's completed works.
So you think, like, the Klingons would have had their equivalent already?
Shakespeare was originally, Shakespeare is a Klingon. I don't think most people, I mean, that was covered up. It's a conspiracy.
How did it get to England?
But,
the Klingons, like, have a long, rich history. They were exploring space long before humanity was.
Right. You're saying
we were part of their territory originally.
Maybe that's why the English got so into powdered wigs and stuff to cover up the ridges.
it was a disguise. But I love the quotes, and who better to do some Shakespeare than Christopher Plummer, such a great actor. And
The first Klingon to ever win an Oscar.
Yep. And then David Warner, another great voice, great actor. And they bring the gravitas without overdoing it. You know, some people, when they do Shakespeare, like overemphasize. And so I think it just fits very well with the theme of this movie and what's going on. Plus, you know, Hamlet and Shakespeare in general, very theatrical. You know, later on we hear about Klingon opera. So, you know, theater and opera, grandiose, you know, thing. And then look at the court scene. That could almost be.
We established that they're a cultured people, and I really like that.
Well, you have to also keep in mind that this film established a lot of the lore for the Klingon Empire that we saw in the latter part of TNG.
Which is interesting, because supposedly one of the things that Gene Roddenberry didn't like about this movie was the way the Klingons were portrayed, because they weren't in line with the TNG Klingons.
Well, most of the development of TNG Klingons occurred after his death, so this was kind of, like I said, it established the lore that allowed TNG to really run and explore what it meant to be Klingon.
Well, and this is such a heavy Klingon movie. I mean, obviously we have other races involved, and we see probably more time with, you know, the Enterprise and Sulu on the Excelsior, so we get a lot of that, but it is very Klingon focused. But I liked how, if you look at this movie in the whole, you know, in its place among all of Star Trek, it gives us another look at Klingons, where it's kind of like, it feels very Klingon, it makes perfect sense, and, you know, carries it forward, but at the same time, it's not like been there, done that, where, you know, it is a new look at the Klingons. It's pushing them forward, but it's not the TNG Klingon, TNG DS9 Klingons. It's not, you know, the original series, of course, but it's even like Krug with Christopher Lloyd. It sets up kind of a progression where you could kind of look at them from the beginning, and it seems like they grow and evolve and develop. And, you know, especially, I mean, from a, you know, outside vantage point of looking at Star Trek, but also internally, like in the story, in the universe, of them dealing with the politics and the cultural exchanges and everything.
So it's a different kind of look at the Klingons, but it's still a good movie for Klingons. or like Klingon portrayal.
It really fleshes out,
Yeah,
it shows them as a complete culture and not mindless warriors that, you know, just
like I said, I really liked how much how this movie establishes that they are a cultured people also, in addition to being warrior people.
I would think that this movie might have even given some, like, impetus for the way that they got the Klingons, that is, were treated in later TNG and Deep Space Nine, because if you look at early TNG, the Klingons, like, obsession with the warrior ethos gets to be a little silly at some points, right?
Yeah.
A little.
Whereas in this movie, they're clearly still a warrior culture, right? Like, they aren't afraid of dying, and that's part of the reason why I think that they have the, you know, the undiscovered country future, and they're still very martial. Gorkon's carrying around his giant, like, mammoth tusk for a cane, and, but they aren't, like, you know, so incredibly set on fighting that everything else has to take a back seat to it. And that was how I saw them, especially when they got Martok into the picture. I think that was how the Klingons became more and more in that direction. They became better rounded, as it were.
Well, yeah. I think what Martok had done, because he wasn't warrior cast initially, he grew up as, you know, from farmers. So, he was able to kind of bring the Empire back into balance. In Enterprise, I think it was, we had learned that the warrior caste was all the rage. It had, you know, become the most important part of this culture. It was kind of like, they had, not devolved, but, kind of like taken a step back in their development and as a civilization. And Martok was just kind of, you know, was taking the first steps to kind of bring the Empire up to date, so to speak. In the Gorkon novels, we see,
like, they'd fallen into a dark age or something?
Kind of. This time for the Empire is a dark time. We see that throughout TNG and Deep Space Nine, when, you know, all the wars all the political bickering and how corrupt everybody was. And, you know, so this was a dark time for the Empire. And as I said, David can attest, we both have read the Gorkon novels, and we see how Martok takes a more enlightened role, viewpoint when it comes to dealing with other species. He doesn't toe the traditional, you know, let's enslave everybody. He's willing to see other races as potential allies, as a way to make the Empire stronger, rather than, you know, another enslaved person or another
enslaved race. Yeah, we get a better
sense
of diplomacy with them with this film.
Yeah.
And
so
then Genpop killed
them.
I still don't buy it. I think I think Genpok's a changeling. Like, maybe Martok is like in carbonite somewhere. So I don't know.
Just don't know.
Just to kind of continue slightly with the Martok and the Gorkon novels, it mentions that he brings back the Order of the Bat'leth to their original purpose, focus, and goal as upholding honor, the honor code set forth by Kalis. And that kind of shows that in the novels, we've seen it in TNG and some of the movies, and especially this one, that there are some people that wouldn't necessarily be following the warrior code, almost like a martial artist or a Shaolin monk, right, type
of
thing.
Right, like there are other paths to follow in Klingon culture.
Right, and some of that would be like military bureaucrat, almost like the warhawk type people in a military sense. And then
an entire culture cannot just be made up of warriors. That they wouldn't get anything done. They wouldn't be able to function.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there was like an order of the Bat'leth that was, you know, almost like checks and balances against, is this an honorable, you know, conduct? Is this an actions or, you know, viewpoint? And then repercussions if it isn't, you know, to try to follow the, and obviously the Kalis lore and all that comes later after this movie. But if we're going to apply it to that, it kind of shows that Chang would have been that kind of militaristic, not bureaucrat exactly, but like the more warhawk general type that just wants to get the mission done.
There's a lot of warhawks in this film,
right? And
on
it's
both
like
sides, but yeah, you're right.
are they really being like the honorable warrior? And so it shows that Mark Chang is working with other conspirators, you know, to bring almost like to take down their own president in a way. So it just, it's interesting to show, and that, that not all Klingons think alike. They're not a monoculture. And then, like Grace just said, I liked how this movie was probably the first time, at least in the big way, that we see non-warrior, non-defense force captains, because we get the whole court scene, and it's like, you know, diplomats and the legal system, and that was just very cool to see more layers to it. Of, and in the Rurapente, there would be like the prison guards, and, you know, we see more aspects of the culture, jobs or duties or whatever, than just starship captain.
Oh, sorry, I thought I had my type, my speak to type on. What I was saying is that it's always, there's always more to do in the Empire, right? And it's really cool whenever we see a Klingon who is doing something other than fighting, because they have a unique way of doing it, and I really appreciate that. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about just beyond the Klingonness of the movie, which is something we'll probably end up getting back to, is the how the movie actually looked visually. Also, I think we might have lost Grace. Well, hopefully she will be able to connect back. But one thing that's interesting about this movie, just from a visual standpoint, is did you notice that the shields work differently here than they usually do? Instead of being like, you know, these this bubble that
it's sort of a major shield inconsistency problems.
Oh, there you are, Grace. You're back. I thought we'd lost you.
Yeah, sorry, tech problems.
Yeah, but it's just, did you notice in this movie the shields are like damage, like basically damage reduction as opposed to just damage deflection. Like they don't. It's like instead of the torpedo hitting the shields and there being this like bubble around the ship, it's like the torpedo still hits the ship and there's still a scar on it, but it doesn't do as much damage because the shields are still up.
Oh, I see what you mean. It's acting more as kind. It's not deflecting or a solid surface any longer, but it's there's a lot of bleed through. It almost slows down the projectile, so it doesn't do as much kinetic damage as it did before.
Yeah, basically. And it's, I think they did that because it's much more dramatic. Like, if you have a bunch of ships firing at each other and all it's doing is it's hitting the shields, like, it just doesn't have the same punch to it. And we saw that actually in Nemesis, which we'll get to in a few weeks. Whereas in this movie, when every time the bird of prey lands a hit, it's like, oh god, we just got hit with like a 40 megaton warhead. As opposed to, oh, that's fine, the shields will take care of it.
Now, this is total, like, you know, conjecture, fan fiction, basically, whatever, but what if...
Fanon, if you will.
Yeah, right. And, well, and a, like, theory, not that, whatever, but what if Valeris tinkered with it slightly? I mean, they had somebody on the conspiratorial side on the ship. I mean, she couldn't just totally sabotage.
And
she
didn't. Thought,
and
yeah.
She was everywhere.
And
I
she
mean, someone
did mention
to tie a bell around her neck. I mean, seriously, she was picking up on everybody in every conversation.
Yeah. Well, and she did mention sabotage, and so she couldn't just totally sabotage.
Sabotage.
Right.
Yeah. She was. She was in the middle of it all pretty much the entire time. She had all the answers. She had, she was in the middle of it all the
that,
entire.
That kind of problem. My problem with the predictability of her betrayal is that she just kind of shows up and she inserts herself so much into this movie and into everything that's going on, and she's so just oddly helpful and convenient, and you can't help but wonder what's up with her. And
right.
That kind of bugged me out, because you could kind of see her betrayal coming because of that.
Which is part of, since we're on this topic, this part of the reason why I do, as much as I love this movie, I do, after a long think about it, I wish that it had been Saddock.
Yeah.
Just because...
Yeah, that would have made it feel more natural to trust her as a character, and it would have made the betrayal have more gravitas.
Yeah, because it wouldn't have been, hey, here's a brand new character, and she's doing all this, like, super important stuff, and she's in your face the entire movie, and, oh, I guess she was our traitor. Because it kind of had to be her. There was really no one else it could
Who
have
else
been.
Would it have been, yeah.
Maybe Chekhov. He was
definitely
acting...
not the guy with the big D.
Dax!
Yes,
Dax.
You know,
yeah, Dax.
We
what
hate
is the
that
problem?
Because it would have...
Well,
go ahead, Adam.
Well, and here's the thing. In the early movies with Savick, it was in the script or in the, you know, early notes that she was supposed to be half Romulan, they never really address that with the Savick character. But then with this character, Valeris...
Ah, that actually makes sense.
There was, you know, also yeah. another side about her yeah. being partly Romulan or just a Romulan. But, like, so I think it's in the novels or the script notes or something.
There is a big Romulan connection in this. And it would have... I think you're right. It would have probably worked a lot better.
Because with Valeris, even way back when this movie first came out, and, you know, I was watching it over on VHS, and, you know, all over the, or way, way back, I always felt she felt Romulan to me. And because, but at the same time, she was a cool Vulcan.
Can we just say for a minute that Kim Cattrall does a great job? She's
character. Awesome.
Yeah.
I've always just liked her in general, going, like, you know, Big Trouble in Little China, Sex in the City. I mean,
further adds to the idea, though, that she's kind of wasted after Sex in the City when people see that as her, and she hasn't really gotten to do many roles outside of that these days, has she? Which is a real shame.
It might be there's some, like, stereotyping or pigeonholing from a
character.
Oh, definitely,
yeah.
But then also, I think, just an unfortunate thing in general in all of Hollywood and media is that they don't always give good roles to women that are past a certain age. Or,
damn right, they don't.
Bleh.
So that sucks. Yeah. But
Double standard.
We're, you know, on the thing of Valeris. Do you guys remember that if it was in the script notes or anywhere in a novel or something that Valeris had Romulan, like was a Romulan or half Romulan? Because if it's continuing the Savick thing, then we would think, yeah, she's definitely half Romulan. That was supposed to be Savick, so it's just basically a different actress with a different name, but supposed to be the Savick character. But because to me, all the way back, Kim Cattrall did a great job being Vulcan. There were some scenes where
she makes a great Vulcan.
She nailed it. But then there were certain little glimmers, certain moments where I thought.
Yeah.
It's very subtle. It's not overly done. But I'm like, you could see there's like smugness or satisfaction or there's like little glimmers of expression of emotion. That would not be Vulcan. And I thought a long time ago, I was telling people, like my friends and on chat rooms or boards or whatever, like, she's a Romulan. And they're like, you're crazy. She's a Vulcan. They would have known all this and that. And I'm like, all this time later, it just makes more sense and just feels right. And as much as Romulan is involved in it, it would make sense. And then it would continue with later on how Spock would be with the unification thing, trying to bring Vulcans and Romulans together and all that. But I just really like the character. And we started off with the visual look of it, and then we jumped to Valeris. But even to kind of bridge those two together, her look, her hairstyle, and like the way it's like not really having the sideburns and her whole look I thought was cool. And I had seen in
she
one
has
of
hair
the...
like Robin, the Swedish pop singer, and I can never get over that in the movie now.
At the time, I heard that Kim Cattrall chose her hairstyle, like she did that as herself, so that was just a very cool choice and cool for her.
So I've been listening to all this, and you guys have come up with some very interesting ideas. One thing that does occur to me, as cool as it is to have this background knowledge that Savick was supposed to be half Romulan, and then connecting it with the Romulan involvement in this plot in Star Trek VI,
that's kind of racist, isn't it?
Well, I don't even know if it's racist so much as I think that in order for Star Trek VI to work as well as it does, the resistance to the peace treaty has to come from within the Federation, and Savick, or Valeris, excuse me, or even if she was Savick, has to arrive at the conclusion that peace with the Klingons is illogical on her own. Because it has to show that this was not something that everyone was just ready to embrace, and it was only, like, a few manipulative people who were trying to stop it behind the scenes, right? In order for it to have the real impact that it has. And if it had been Savick, I wanted it to be Savick so badly because it would have redeemed Savick somewhat for her scene in Star Trek III when David is killed and she stands there and does nothing. And if during this movie, I think if they had played up that both Kirk and Savick are, you know, distraught over David's death and trying to deal with it, and in the end, Kirk is able to move past it and Savick isn't, because yeah. Savick was there, and she blames herself for it happening, and she transfers that blame onto the Klingons, because she can't think of any, she can't come up with any other way to reconcile it, because it has to have been the Klingons' fault. And I think that would have been a beautiful, tragic end cap to that character. And it's, I know that that isn't what actually happened in the movie, and I understand that there are legitimate reasons for people not wanting it to have been Savick, but I just think that would have been so beautiful for a character that had promise at the beginning, but as a result of various things, was never really played out properly.
Also, it would have added to just the over arc that we get with the original cast in these original movies. Just that it would make it really a lot more self-contained, and I thought that would have really added to it.
Yeah, and according to what's being said in the chat room, they're mentioning that Valeris in some of the novels is just revealed to have been a Romulan, and I just don't like that. I think that it's, I can see why they did it, but it just doesn't make sense to me. I don't like the idea that in order to have been against the peace process, you have to have had this some like exterior motivation, right? It, you can't have just been from the Federation.
That
and,
kind of also kills.
Can we talk about the Romulan in the room?
The
Romulan in the room.
Here, hang on. All right, Grace, you say what you were going to say, then we'll talk about the Romulan in the room.
Well, I feel like that just having it be, if you have Romulan connections, you're against the Federation and what have you, that kind of kills the point of the movie, that there is dissent within Starfleet and it's not a perfect system. And there are people who are willing to get shady to get what they want within Starfleet, you know? I felt like that was one of the big things that's a theme of the movie, that that Starfleet is not perfect, and
well, especially look at like Cartwright, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Well, and that it's not a perfect system.
Like I said earlier, like early on when I was first watching it, I thought she was dead on Romulan. Like I didn't even remember or know that she was full Romulan in the books. But the more I thought about it, like you said, I think it would be better if she was a full, like actual Starfleet officer, not a, you know, spy double agent, but a half Romulan, half Vulcan, who just has the political view of like, we need to protect the Federation and not go with the Klingons, even if it ain't Savick, if it's Valeris. I mean, there could be more than one half Romulan, half Vulcan in Starfleet, but
that's to establish that there are people within Starfleet who've got different ideas on how these this stuff should be handled. That just rounds out Starfleet so much more, doesn't it?
I personally agree. And sorry, you wanted to talk about the Romulan in the room, but I assume you mean the Romulan ambassador who is for some reason allowed to stay and witness the top secret, you know, briefing on trying to rescue Kirk and Spock.
I don't know.
He's sneaky too, I guess.
Sorry, Kirk and McCoy.
Well, I've read the Rihansu novels, and by reading through that series, I understand the Romulan motivation. The Romulans they act from a position of fear when dealing with other races. They were invaded early on, which prompted them to leave Vulcan, and that underlying fear motivates all of their actions, and they use subterfuge and manipulation in order to get what they want. And from the Romulan perspective, what the possibility of war between the Klingons and the Federation only helps them. It puts them into a position to be able to wipe out both without having to try as hard. So having the Romulan, you know, at these top level meetings, he has access to people to within both factions through the ambassadors, through the diplomatic corps, to make connections with Warhawks on both sides, and to kind
and
of
he would be in a good position to be like an information gatherer, like by being in the room. But then also to subtly manipulate those people,
yeah,
too.
To plant information as well, to motivate both sides into acting. It would very, very possible for him to just plant just enough evidence or just enough information to make both sides just a little bit more paranoid, especially among individuals who are already so invested in not war, but in the Klingons are our enemy, or the Federation is our enemy. It's very easy to just keep feeding them just enough rope to hang themselves. And that's what the Romulans were doing in this.
And at the same time, like, influencing the other two parties, but then not getting any heat on themselves, because I always thought it was, like, you know, very, I don't know the right descriptor for it, but it's like when he's like, the Klingon is going, we got to kill Kirk or get Kirk because he killed him. And the Federation president's like, you can't possibly believe that Kirk would do this. The Romulan doesn't take a stand. Like, he's noncommittal. Like, I don't know what to believe. Like, he's not committing himself to one side or the other.
He's letting the evidence, you know, speak for him. And it's the evidence that he has carefully manipulated into being. You know, it could be Section 31 for the Federation that's kind of helped, you know, this process along. But yeah, the Romulans were behind it. I saw that. I noticed that when watching this time.
I don't think you even need to involve Section 31 in this particular plot. And frankly, I think Section 31, knowing everything that we know, would actually probably have been for the peace treaty, because Section 31 wants what's, you know, going to strengthen the Federation, and peace with the Klingons will certainly strengthen the Federation, especially because a lot of what we've seen in Star Trek shows that in a war between Starfleet and the Federation, the Federation would lose. So, but the Romulans, it makes total sense why the Romulans would want to sabotage that peace treaty, because right now... go ahead.
Also, for a second, just think what Section 31 would do if they had Klingon assets.
Well, yeah. that's the kind of thing where we see, like, there's different, throughout the different TNG, but even the movies, there's times where we see certain Starfleet generals or admirals or, you know, commodores, whatever, they want to be more military, and there's always, like, the resistance to that, where if they were allied with the Klingons, that would, like, give the Federation and Starfleet a military asset or resources without Starfleet themselves having to become more militaristic and aggressive. So it would be making sense to say, let's ally with them. And then Section 31 would probably still surveillance on them, still probably try to, you know, influence.
Yes, but you have to also keep in mind, Klingons are not to be tamed. They are not someone's
lapdog. Oh, no doubt. Right. They wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't do whatever the Federation is.
Being, you know, pulled in or you know, undermined or controlled in any way. The Empire is proud. So,
well, but that's the reality of it from the Klingon ally. Side. Whereas
that makes
from
them
the
dangerous ally.
But from the Federation standpoint, they probably would still think, like, we need to get them on our side. You know what you say? What it's true. Like, the Klingons wouldn't be like the Vorta to the Dominion. They're not just going to take orders and, you know, do other people's bidding. But from the Federation viewpoint, it could easily be seen like we need them on our side more than being against them, because it would benefit them. But then at the same time, that's like political and, you know, governmental type stuff. And all throughout this movie, as much as almost we see of Shakespeare, we could see instances of racism against the Klingons from the Starfleet people. And there's like another cultural thing too, where maybe some in Starfleet and the Federation would say they're totally different than us, but, you know, diversity, it helps both sides be stronger, and, you know, we should be tolerant and all that. But then there's the other sides that you could see that they're just going to be racist and not accept them as people, because we hear the classic, unfortunate, but the classic real world comments, like, they all look alike, they smell, you know, talking about their animals, you know, and just diminishing
them.
Even
the guest is coming to dinner line.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's coming from Chekhov himself, not just these flunkies in the transporter room, but, you know, referencing, like,
this is a culturally ingrained thing they've got going on, that they just do not trust the Klingons. And
it's easy to hate.
Yeah. It's much easier to just hate a group of people than to compromise with them.
Yeah, and again, I think that this is all part of why it makes more sense for this to be a legitimate culture clash, right? Like, this isn't a case of some, you know, tiny group like Section 31 trying to sabotage a peace process that's going to go just fine on its own, right? This has legitimate obstacles, and I think that this movie portrays that very, very well. And it makes me a little sad to hear all this back behind the scenes stuff of people being so unwilling to say these lines, like that. There's a lot of people were just very upset about the way that this portrayed the Federation, and I don't really understand why, because watching the original series, that's just what the Federation was. Like, if you look at how opposed they are to the Klingons, it's just there, and I don't understand why people want to pretend like that never happened. Like, in the first episode where we meet Klingons, they're ready to go to war over this planet with basically nothing on it. It's like, hey, let's fight over Organia, even though it is home to an entire population of, like, 30 farmers. Yeah, that sounds like a planet we should go to war over.
Right,
yeah,
medieval.
It's there.
And it's clearly a parallel to, you know, the domino effect, right, that we were all so worried about. We were like, we have to fight communism wherever it goes, even if it doesn't really benefit us and there's no real reason to do it. And that's what was going on in those early TOS episodes. And we found out that we needed to make peace with the Klingons. But in this movie, even though it's just, I see it as a very natural continuation of TOS, for some reason, people were so against a lot of what was happening. Gene Roddenberry didn't like it. You know, Robin Curtis didn't want to come back to play Savick for this role. They had to change some of the lines. They had to give the let's who's coming to dinner line to Chekhov because they didn't like Michelle Nichols
refused to say it. Yeah, she didn't... knew that they would be having her say it because she was black.
Which, I mean, that part I can understand, like, especially since, you know, I could definitely believe that Uhura would know what that line is originally about, and so she probably wouldn't say it. Like, that
part.
Well,
who doesn't?
Well, I mean, in 400 years, you know, like, that's a lot of time for cultural drift. There's enough time in you know, by the 24th century for us to think that Shakespeare might be a Klingon.
Like, well, you have to also keep in mind that even Sisko in Deep Space Nine was still very bitter about, you know, how his people were treated in the past. So
that's a thing they get to be bitter about.
Well, because it's a cultural thing. It's not just, you know, Uhura and Sisko and. But because look at in the Next Generation episode, Journey's End, it's all those years later, and there's still the Native Americans that remember what, you know, their ancestors went through, what their culture had to endure and survive through and, you know, come back from. So there are certain things that would be, you know, long in the memory going forward of certain races or cultures or people. So, but I on a similar note, I kind of, it wasn't lost on me, even in the early times watching the movie, that when they're giving the briefing and Spock is saying, you know, they've been our enemy basically, but now they're in a position of vulnerability and they can't sustain the animosity and the war type thing. So let's take this time to reach out to them and help them rebuild and everything. And the first person to dissent and say no and basically start spewing out some racism was Admiral Cartwright, who was a black man. So it's like, you know, it was a twist on that, but it was kind of ironic or, you know, just twisted that it's not going to be the typical, and maybe that's good. So it's not a white man saying racist stuff, because that might, you know,
well,
be
it just
continuing
shows racism is universal.
Right, and it's, I guess in this case, it might, what, speciesism?
Speciesism.
Right.
Speciesism, anthropocentrism.
Right, and I don't want to sound like I'm insensitive, but I do think that there is a difference between having prejudice in your movie and your movie being prejudice, right?
Right, exactly.
Like,
yeah,
Star Trek VI is all about rejecting those ideas, but they have to be there in order to reject them. Like, you can't have a movie about overcoming prejudice if you just refuse to have any of your characters be prejudice. And obviously that isn't what happened, right? We have plenty of prejudice characters in Star Trek VI. And it is a beautiful movie because of that. It's just interesting to read all the behind the scenes, and I'd be curious to know what kind of conflicts took place, you know, behind the camera to get this all, you know, out the way that it was, right?
That'd be an audio commentary worth listening to, yeah.
So it's just, I get very emotional about this movie, like, more so than I get even about Star Trek II, just because of how powerful the themes are for me, and how relevant they still are now. Like, you know, it's still, we have all these problems of these national relationships that are not going very well, and it feels like we should be able to move beyond that, and we still haven't been able to. And that's
one of the big things of Star Trek, though. This is something we should be able to move past by now. In the future, we will have moved past this, and pointing out that those aren't things that have been moved past is probably part of what Roddenberry would have had trouble with this movie.
It's a struggle that we're always going to have, and it's going to require, you know, vigilance and a lot of effort in order to overcome. But it's also
about breaking the cycle, because if we look at, you know, what would be in Starfleet or Star Trek era, like those times, there probably wouldn't be much racism between, you know, Africans, Chinese, you know, of the human planet. Like, but then there's that collective view that's like continuing the cycle against other cultures, other races from other planets. So even though there's been some progress internally, or like on our planet, or, you know, in the Federation, there's still that, you know, reaction to other cultures that are so alien or so dissimilar and so unrelatable.
There will always be that idea of us and them.
Yeah. Or at least it'll
in Enterprise. In Enterprise, we did see, you know, I forget the title of that arc, but we did see that, you know, it is something that everyone struggles with, you know, to overcome, because it is easier to hate than it is to accept. And I mean, that's how our evolution taught us, you know. You're scared of what's different. You're scared of what's in the dark.
Right. And here's the thing I want to highlight, that there are kind of two ways that Star Trek goes about commenting on issues that we have today. There's the subtle way, which is that in the future, that's not going to be an issue anymore. And that's how they did it with, you know, putting Uhura on the bridge. There aren't any episodes about having to have a civil rights conflict to have Uhura on the bridge, because just in the future, that won't be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Which is certainly very powerful. But then there's the other way, which is to highlight it as an episode, whereas this is something that we have to see the Star Trek characters grapple with. And I think there's a place for both, but I think, you know, peace with the Klingons and overcoming of, you know, nationalistic and racial prejudice towards aliens, that is something that I think needed to be in Star Trek. It couldn't just be something we'd say, yeah, I guess we're just friends with the Klingons now. You know, you can't have the entire original series where the Klingons were our sworn enemy, and then suddenly in TNG they're our friends with no bridge. Like, there needed to be something.
That is something that has to be addressed, yeah.
And that's why I love the position of this movie and it doing that. And the fact that it shows it's not an easy transition. It's not just like, okay, let's just all sing Kumbaya and have a good time.
Always forgiving.
Right. With the Gorkon saying, you know, if there is going to be this peace in the future, like Kirk and the current generation will have the hardest time living in it, dealing with it, going through it, building it, you know. That just shows it is a difficult thing. But that's also the optimistic view of Star Trek, of saying, even though there are these still like problems and issues that would have to be addressed and continuing, progress could still be made. You know, it takes work, it takes effort, but the right people at the right position, you know, would be able to go through the difficult times and, you know, build the bridge, which is, you know, a big bridge and a long one. So it's like, you know, it's not just a little quick little easy thing, but at the same time, we're kind of going through a couple different things. I think I saw this movie as two layers that went together well and kind of go interchangeably and affect, you know, one affecting the other, is the cultural racism, like, you know, just basically just racism and culture clash type aspect, like when they're like, did you see how they ate, and all this other comments. But then the other half of it is like the political governmental aspects, and it's very similar to like the Cold War with the, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States and other countries dealing with, you know, the politics and the governmental power plays and resources, and, you know, who is going to make treaties with each other, who's going to go to war, and sometimes, you know, that's blurry. So I thought this was a very cool thing for Star Trek to do, to be able to address those both at the same time, like, you know, together in the same scenario, and still feel like Star Trek. It's not just, you know, it's still, there's still some fun to the movie. There's still, you get the not cliches, but like the Spockisms and the Bones comments, and, you know,
there's even a Christian Slater cameo. What more could you want?
Right. Great. Yeah. Great actors, great characters. And, you know, Bones, like, what is it with you, man? Like, why you're kissing aliens again? But
yeah,
it was just such a well-rounded movie with so many layers to it.
Well, have you noticed that this is the movie where Spock is the main character? Like, Kirk's good in this movie. He does a good job. But Spock is really the one driving the plot.
Spock is the one who kind of has to take the leadership position, doesn't he?
He really does. And, you know, we've got the prison sequences, which are not my favorite part of the movie, but they work reasonably well with Kirk's whole attitude of being really suited to being in a situation where he has, you know, he has his back against the wall and only his wits to get out of that situation. Where you have
I think it was in the Sci-Fi Debris review that they were saying that in this movie, they really have the characters playing to their strengths in that sense. They've got Kirk kind of having to think fast and defend himself, and Spock having to do the logical thing and to figure out where the sabotage came from and what have you.
Sabotage.
Sabotage.
Oh, excellent. Oh, I mean, too bad.
Well, we're on the subject of characters, because the big three get pretty good roles. You know, McCoy, maybe not the greatest, although him trying to save Gorkon is a pretty good scene, and him being truly appalled at the trial is also good. But Sulu is probably one of my only sticking points in this movie, because I love Sulu having his own command. I love the way that George Takei handles himself in that role. He really, you know, he gives an aura of command. Like, I believe he is the captain.
It really is cool to see Sulu come into his own like that. And when you see it, you get this idea of, about damn time.
Way more than, Sulu, you know, Captain Writing Prop.
Sorry, I'm going to divert the high-tech conversation for a second, but in I think it's Generations, we see that he had a family, he had a daughter, he's got his career, he has it all. I mean, good for him. I love Sulu.
And in this movie, I thought it was cool. I mean, it probably was the plan all along, but it's just from, you know, one standpoint of looking at it. I thought it was cool that when we see Sulu as captain, which, you know, felt natural, he did a great job at it. But at the same time, I was happy that he was the captain of the Excelsior, or at least an Excelsior class. I think it was the Excelsior, right?
It was the Excelsior.
Right, that's what my first thought. But then remember all the way back to Star Trek, the previous movies, where they're like, that bucket of bolts, and it's, you know, the riding crop captain.
And Sulu always loved it.
Right.
Yeah.
He liked that ship, and he probably made it its goal at that moment to become captain of that vessel.
Right, you know, Scotty's saying he didn't like it. The others are like, eh, whatever. Sulu was like, I like that ship. So later on, he gets to be the captain.
Just as soon as he gets to redecorate the bridge.
Hey, that bridge looks amazing, and he's got matching ship-wide china sets and everything. Seriously.
Yeah, gotta love that cup. But
that is classy as hell.
Yep. And like I said, he somehow, where you know, a lot of Starfleet officers come across as, you know, as being, that is more than just their job. That is who they are. Look at Kirk. I mean, that his life is captain of the Enterprise. And here we see a captain, Sulu, who, like I said earlier, has it all. He has a family. He has a daughter. He's got his career. He got the ship that he wanted.
Sulu is the real hero here, I guess.
Well, if you remember way back in the very early episodes of TOS, they used to leave Sulu in charge when Kirk and Spock would beam down to the planet. Like, they did that a couple of times before they decided to haul Scotty up from engineering to make him do it, because naturally the last place you'd want your chief engineer is in engineering.
You really want the drunk Scotsman making decisions.
So it's, you know, it's a natural progression for Sulu, but that is one of the few stumbling points of this movie, is, and this has been pointed out before, but I need to point it out now again, is that he, you know, he has that great line, fly her apart then, he shows up to help the Enterprise, and then does nothing. Because for some reason, suddenly it's the Enterprise now that has the equipment of tracking gaseous anomalies to defeat the Bird of Prey. So really,
it should have been the other way around.
It should have.
Were they also studying gaseous anomalies?
Yeah,
that's their mission. It's the law of Star Trek.
Kirk always has to be the one to save the day.
Right, and that's the thing that is obnoxious, is that because they still have that sequence in the beginning where they talk about the Excelsior cataloging gaseous anomalies. That was supposed to be what happened, is that the Excelsior was going to show up and provide the solution that would allow Kirk to, you know, defeat the Bird of Prey and then beam down to save the president. But at least according to some sources, that was axed because Shatner didn't like it, which is obnoxious, especially because...
Like I said, Kirk always has to save the day.
Yeah, except like 10 minutes previously when he was rescued by Spock. I mean, it's silly. I just don't understand it.
Kirk always saved the day, Orin!
Yeah, apparently. and the fact that if you just remove the Excelsior from the last like 20 minutes of the movie, really nothing has to change. Like, I love Sulu in this movie. And I just, in my mind, I always re-edit that scene, because after Sulu says, "Fly her apart," then I just can't picture anything but the Excelsior, you know, charging in to rescue the Enterprise. Like, that's perfect. That gives the movie, like, perfect beats and timing, but it just does not actually happen.
Well, they did give the Klingons another target, so it allowed, you know, the Klingons' attention to be diverted, so away from the Enterprise, which... You know, could be argued that is saving the Enterprise. You know, giving them an opportunity to figure out the situation without, you know, flying apart.
I suppose, but...
The Excelsior is the universe's most expensive meat shield.
Well, he does say, like, you know, we're ready to assist, so maybe the point of there was... I agree, I would have preferred it if they did some science with the Excelsior and got the save the day with the gas thing, but at least the way it is now, like, Sulu was there. He was backing up his former captain and crew. He wasn't going to let them, you know, face danger. There's a Klingon proverb, never let a friend face danger alone. So, you know, at least in that regard, he shows up, he helps, he's there, you know, he's assisting. So I don't hate it, but I definitely agree they should have had Sulu, you know, do the gas thing.
Yeah, I just think that would have worked out better. But regardless, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, Sulu has a great role in this movie. And, you know, we spent a long time just discussing the moral implications of this film. And we talked a little bit about Solaris. One thing that I wanted to mention, that, again, this is another thing that really kind of makes me...
Solaris, Orin?
Did yeah. I just...
Did you say Solaris?
I did. Yeah. One thing about this movie that gets
Savick
me...
Well, and Valeris together combined, like two Vicks.
By their powers combined, they are...
That's a good name for her.
Okay, you guys are just never going to let
I'm
me forget
about
that.
I'm seconding that motion, yeah.
So there's the scene that I wanted to talk about a little bit is the forced mind melt sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel like I'm getting gut punched when I watch that sequence.
The rape scene? Yeah.
The brain rapage, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And before we delve into it, that was one of the reasons a long time ago where I thought she's not really 100% Vulcan. Because her reaction to it is like so, you know, like being violated, and I thought would Spock really like force himself that hard? And in a way, he is. I mean, like yes, but her reaction was also to me almost like she wasn't used to being probed and mind melded. But then the force of it, maybe another Vulcan would like still have the mental resolve to, you know, withstand it better. I don't think that's like a good
thing to say.
That would kind of
make sense, I guess.
But well, she was unprepared for it.
I found that scene very difficult to watch because it was A, condoned by Kirk and encouraged and kind of forced upon Spock. And then it was, so he was almost as much of a victim as she was. It was not something that he really wanted to do, but he was forced to by his captain.
Well,
and then on top of it,
the needs of many outweigh.
And on top of it, it's happening in front of everyone on board the ship on the bridge.
It's pretty public as far as invasive procedures go. Yeah.
Yeah, and it just for me, it just really did not sit right because there was just so much going on, and no one on no one in the crew objected. I mean, it was like
the movie doesn't really acknowledge it either. And
kind of yeah.
A little for me is the fact that they don't even say, yeah, that happened. It just happened.
Yeah, it's okay. So clearly some of the crew members are also not comfortable with it, right? We get some reaction shots of Uhura and Scotty, and they both have very like looks on their faces. And part of the problem is, like you said, it happened and then it was over, right? Like Spock never seems to feel bad about it. It's
there's
just,
no remorse. No.
Right. And what makes it even worse for me is that, okay, so I can buy that maybe it was necessary because they had to learn the names of the conspirators. It's still a very distasteful act. Maybe it had to be done. But then the part where she really is clearly in pain is when they're like, where's the peace conference? And Excelsior apparently just knew, and Spock knew that. Why didn't he just cut the mind meld off once they knew the people who were in the conspiracy and then call Excelsior?
Like,
yeah.
I have a hard time believing Spock is that vindictive. Like, I understand that he's angry.
Maybe he was just really upset after that level of betrayal.
And then there was this whole, later on in the same scene, Kirk, he ends up asking her. And I almost had the sense that, you know, she had no choice but answer. You know, otherwise he was going to stick his pet Vulcan on her again. You know, it was like
Spock.
So you know, I was like wondering who are these people at that point. It's like I was just surprised and just it didn't sit well.
I mean, I'm all for Star Trek having moral ambiguity, and I'm surprised that people were so objectionable to the idea of the Federation, you know, having prejudice against the Klingons. But I haven't read anything about anybody objecting to this scene. And it just, I feel like it was done without any real consideration of what the actual implications were. And if they had thought it out a little bit more, I think they could have done it in a way that actually worked. And especially what I would have preferred is to have the movie, because it's partially about Valeris, right? To have it be her maybe even realizing that she was wrong. Like something happening in the film to convince her that,
she backed the wrong side.
That
but
she
no,
needs
there's
to
no real closure there, is there?
No, and her last line is telling them just the prototype, and I felt like there needed to be more. Like, they needed to pursue that character a little farther.
I would definitely like to have seen more, yeah.
And I know they didn't have a lot of time, but there are some things they could have cut. Like, frankly, the prison escape sequence is too long. Like, there's no reason for that.
But Iman was there.
I like Iman
The parts that I
everyone thought, likes Iman.
Well, she's cool, but the thing that I think would
Mrs.
say
Bowie,
with
damn you
exactly, and she has great products on QVC. She's awesome. She's cool. I always appreciated her acting, her character.
Oh man, did you see her in Out of Africa?
Yeah, don't doubt. She's very very cool. I would have probably cut some of the scenes where they're just like from the helicopter watching the people walk on the ice. I mean, that could have.
What? That was the money shot.
You know, well, you can still keep it there. Just, you know, reduce it.
The
or,
money shot.
yeah. But at like the prison scene, that's where you got so many heavy things going on in the movie. You got the racism, you got the like political. Governmental things going on, assassination,
brain rape, and what have you.
Brain rape, you know, mind that, and then you know, basically a presidential assassination story. It's nice to have, you know, to break that up or to, you know, relieve that tension at certain times of by having some of the cute humor. Not, I wouldn't say, you know, don't put in slapstick comedy like Keystone Cops, you know, Starfleet red shirts running around like Keystone Cops or something like Benny Hill, but at least have some humor. So the prison scene with, you know, Kirk and McCoy, I liked that, you know, they were paired up, so we get some of their dynamic, because a lot of Star Trek is Kirk and Spock.
Anyone go really then, when Kirk kicked that alien in the kneecaps? And
that's,
I mean,
not his
yeah,
name.
What
that's
kind
of
alien
a...
keeps their genitals in their kneecaps?
Yeah.
I mean, really? Really? Well,
but what I want to know is why, if that's where you have your genitals for some reason, some quirk of evolution has put them there, why would you have a hole over them?
Yeah, they were totally open air, exposed.
I mean, you know, we don't do that. There's a reason for that.
That's kind of the big eye roll scene of this movie, isn't it?
Well, no, for me, the eye roll scene is Uhura not knowing how to speak Klingon.
Yeah.
At least that's one thing about the new movies. They got that right with Uhura.
Well, the weird scene also about that, because obviously, I mean, they made a choice to play it for the humor. And so, okay. And for one, aside from, it's bad on a couple levels, because it's Uhura being communications person, not being able to, she don't know that language, but she's struggling so bad with it. And it's kind of puts her in a bad light. The Klingons look bad because here's this person's, you know, obvious bad accent, bad language, fumbling through, saying wrong words. We am condemning food and things or whatever she says. And they're like, okay, you know, have a good trip. You know, they just let them go. So that's like looking bad on the Klingons. But the other thing I thought that was weird is like, okay, it's Starfleet. We see them, even in TOS, they would have the clipboards that the yeoman or the Spock would be writing on with like a stylus. In this case, they pull out paper books, like books that are actual paper pages. It's like, where did they just keep all of those? Were those in some storage locker on the bridge? Like, they just pull out stacks and stacks of books. You would almost think, well, just, you know, use the library computer.
They do a lot of printing and faxing on ship, I guess.
They just bust out their entire dictionary collection for this.
Shran in the chat room says in the novel the Klingons gave him a pass because they thought they were smugglers. Which, okay,
that
I mean...
That would make more sense, yeah.
Although, you would think that security around the Klingons, like, super prison would be a little tighter than that, right? Because it's not like anyone would ever try to break somebody out of
prison. What? Never.
Yeah,
people
don't
just break out of jail.
I think that
just surprised that the Enterprise was able to get so close to Rurapinte unchallenged. I mean, that's the shield thing. It's only real true defense. Well, the shield and its natural environment on the surface. Being its only true defense is, you would figure that there would be a lot more orbital defenses in place,
right,
to keep people from being able to get, you know, to the outer, you know,
you
to
have a prison
planet.
In space. That's kind of just what you should do, kind of, pretty much.
Yeah,
right. And you know, I'm willing to, you know, concede the idea that the Enterprise has some sort of, you know, some sort of silent running mode it can go on where it's
a
able
cloaking device. Have
maybe, but where it's able
a what
to,
now?
Where it's able to sneak past, you know, the Klingon border sensors, right? Because it's not like they're going to Kronos and not being detected, because that would never happen in a movie. But it does seem weird that, you know, that they were able to sneak past those two, like, you know, border guards, basically, so easily.
Well, they call it the Morska listening post. And I think it's just, you know, maybe bad economic or something, because we saw in, was it Star Trek 3 or 5? I forget. But we see a Klingon looking at his tactical display, and they got, like, the triangle grid and all the, you know, their tactical display set up. And there's, like, a little image of the Enterprise.
We see that in this one, too.
Right. But, I mean, on the other movie, the indicator looks like a little Enterprise. Like, it's the, you know, the shape of the saucer, the nacelles. We could see, oh, look, that's the Enterprise.
These were just the guys stuck with the crappy equipment then, weren't they?
Right, because when the Morska guy looks at it, it's just like a little triangle that's just floating across the grid. And it's like, they even say, like, what ship is this? That's one of the questions they ask, like, who are you? What ship is it? They just have bad equipment. They can't scan the ship to see, like, is it a Klingon ship or a Federation ship or a Ferengi or, you know, whatever.
Any prison planet worth its salt would have better defenses.
And I mean, I understand that they wanted to have some comedy here in order to keep the mood from being, like, too soul-crushingly serious, but I think they could have done it in a way that didn't make everything look absurd, right? I mean, they could have had Uhura having a conversation with a drunk Klingon, and I think they could have had, that could have been just as funny. Especially because, you know, and we could have had some weird subtitles, and I think that would have worked out very nicely. But, you know, that isn't what happened, right? We can only complain about Uhura not being able to speak Klingon for so long.
Well,
she
spent all of her shore leaves learning how to fan dance. She didn't take the Klingon language course.
Ah!
She had to forget one skill to learn a new one.
Why would you do that, David? You remind me of that. Why? I thought we were friends.
So you never forget.
Yeah, apparently. All right. So let's see. Because we're past the hour. What other stuff do we need to cover? So let's talk about Chang for just a minute, because we've spent like the first 45 minutes talking about the dialogue. So I really like Chang. Like, he's not quite Khan, but he's a very good villain, I think. I think he's easily number
two.
Cool
villain.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, also Christopher Plummer, so he adds that skill to any role.
I think it's pretty clear that he is, of all the Star Trek movies, he's the number two villain. Like, Khan is clearly the best, and I think that Chang comes in a close second, because he, again, you can see his motivations, you can see why he is so opposed to this peace treaty, and it isn't because he's like, you know, a savage, like, you know, slavering moron. It's because he doesn't trust the Federation, and because there is a legitimate amount of distrust in the Federation. It's like, it's not
and
like...
And he's a legitimate threat, so...
Yeah, that too.
Well, and it's also, I liked Chang because aside from, like, Christopher Plummer just being a great actor and the charisma that is, you know, that he is able to put into the character, but it's like he's different than a lot of the other Klingons we've seen. He's not just like the type that would be yelling and like beating on his chest. He's almost like the classical villain that would be like twirling his mustache and, you know, devising, you know, schemes and plots. And then his mannerisms are different, you know, than, it was just a very cool character and in a way a unique take on a Klingon. And then especially, you know, putting him as a general, like in a position of, you know, a threat, a military person. He's not just like that, you know, crazy Klingon shooting at probes and stuff. So it was a very cool character. And in a way, it kind of goes back to, he thought he was doing what was right for his people, for his, you know, country, his government. It wasn't just like, I need power. I need to be a strong, you know, force in the galaxy. They'll write songs about my conquests or anything like that. It was, he thought he was doing what was right for his, you know, his people. So it's, you know, maybe misguided, or, you know, the tactics may not have been the best. You know, there could have been other ways to halt or, you know, prevent the peace treaty. But conspiring with other, you know, I don't know. There's layers to him that I thought, I was happy to see that he wasn't just a one-dimensional bad guy.
Well, yeah, I agreed.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying, agree. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I've also read the Vanguard novels, and in that, it has Gorkon, and it deals with the Khitomer conference, and Chang is even back then, he is a general, and he comes from this, he's very, as we see, he's very educated, and he's really, he is gung-ho for the peace process early on in the Vanguard series. But he eventually becomes disillusioned with Gorkon's plan, which is kind of why we see him so close to Gorkon, yet so willing to betray him in the end. You know, the books really add another layer. And again, as I was talking about earlier with the Romulans and Rihansu, the Vanguard series really adds to what we see on the screen in this film. So I just wanted to throw that out there, that we in the Vanguard novels, we do see a lot of Chang's motivation and how he ends up where he is in this film. So willing and able to kill his chancellor, to, you know, provoke war with the Federation.
I also enjoyed his performance in the courtroom scene, where it's like he's, you know, being stately, being, you know, diplomatic and regal, almost, you know, being like that. And then all of a sudden you see that switch and he starts, you know, becoming where he's yelling, and that classic historical reference about don't wait for the translation, answer me now. Like, it was just a great character on so many different levels. And then he's the one that we get, you know, Klingon Shakespeare quotes from. It's just very cool.
Right. And I also want to give a shout out to Admiral Cartwright, because even though he doesn't have a huge role in the movie, I think he uses what he has very well. And he has, like...
Sisko's dad.
Yeah, and he's Sisko's dad.
Yeah, never forget that he's Sisko's dad.
And even though he is the corrupt admiral trope, which is maybe a little overused, I think, again, he has a real motivation. It isn't just, I'm doing this for my own personal power. It's like, and it helps also that we see other members of Starfleet brass. It's not like he's the only one we ever meet in this movie, right? So I think it was, if you're going to do the corrupt admiral trope, that's the way to do it.
Well, and like we said, like for Chang and for Cartwright, I mean, he may have issues of prejudice and racism on a personal level, but in a way, he's thinking, you know, by doing this whole conspiracy and you know, doing illegal things or bad things, but in his mind, he's probably doing it, you know, thinking this is what, but almost like the ends justifies the means. Like, we need
good
to do
to him, it feels absolutely justified. So
for the outcome,
the road to hell
of the
is paved with good intentions. I mean, that's
right.
That's what
also
one thing
dead
that we definitely
Klingons
saw.
Apparently.
What was that?
Also dead Klingons.
Did also
during Stovacor? It's
yeah,
okay.
They don't ever mention that in this movie. Did you
what's
notice
the road to Stovacor paved with
Fatless?
Dead enemies.
Tribbles.
That too.
The hides of Tribbles.
Although that was one thing about Chang to me that was a little bit obnoxious, is the fact that apparently his Shakespeare quoting is so powerful that it can reach out through space and everyone in the Enterprise can hear it. And it's just like, why are you guys broadcasting his Shakespeare quotes over the entire ship? That seems a little demoralizing.
It's the power of acting, Orin.
Like, maybe you guys should turn that off.
Once again, that was Solaris doing sabotage. She, like, you know, rigged the communication.
I can't turn it off, Captain.
But
the button is stuck. We're on receiving.
Well, we're stuck listening to a soliloquy. Oh, well.
The volume knob's even broken.
This movie in two different cases, and I meant to mention it about Star Trek V when we did that one, but in this movie there's two references that about using money. Early on in the conference scene, Scotty goes, that suits me, I just bought a boat. Like, you bought something? How do you buy something if there's no money? And then when Chang is spouting his Shakespeare, McCoy goes, I'd give real money if he'd shut up. It's like, wait, what? Real money? But then in Star Trek V, when we were talking about the bar scene where Kirk is fighting the Cation or the Cat Lady, there's a computer monitor or like a display in the background talking about the Federation Federal will help you with finances. So, you know, get your house here on. And I'm like, why are they having, you know, like home financing commercials for Federation Federal, which sounds like a bank, but. It is a little weird inconsistencies, but that was the cool thing, too, about Chang. There was some level, like, subtle or, you know, not a whole over the top, but there was some humor and comedy with it. Like, he's spinning in his chair, just spouting out his Shakespeare. It's like, that's kind of, you know, light or fun, but so many great characters, but there is some issues with some of it.
Yeah, again, there's little missteps that they feel like they could have been corrected fairly easily. Like, none of them are problems with the overall structure of the film, which are problems that, you know, Star Trek Motion Picture, Star Trek III, and then mostly Star Trek V all kind of had. They all had structural issues, whereas this movie has a great structure and just has a couple of minor missteps that if they had fixed, it would be even better.
Okay, I could imagine that Martia is a Kamaloid, so she could change her, you know, she's a shapeshifter, she could change her appearance, her body mass, and all that, but she also morphs her clothes, like her furs and pelts that she's wearing morph along with, that was just weird.
She's just actually naked, and she can, that'd be the only way that she'd be able to morph her clothes, is if she was actually walking around naked and able to create whatever she needed.
Look, it's the same effect that causes vampires and Buffy to disintegrate their clothes with them. All right, it's just it's the same, you know, theory.
Which begs the question: was Odo naked for all of Deep Space Nine?
Well, the answer to that
is yes, except for when he was human, because we see that once he got his, you know, his shape shifting ability back, he shed clothes and flew right out of it. So that was actually a good, you know, a good scene, I thought.
Well, and then there was that one other scene where Kira was like, oh, you're not wearing the belt, and then all of a sudden
the belt
just
materializes.
It's like, so yeah, he's, it's a, how would he put it, like a artificial representation or whatever when he was drinking the coke, his beverage thing.
Well, so that entire cup was just part of his hand, yep. And he was filling it up with more of him in the form of coffee, which makes me wonder what would happen if somebody else drank from it. Someone was like really rude and reached over, and
he would have to give it to them because they couldn't take the cup. Otherwise, it'd end up as a pile of goo.
Oh dear!
The coffee would the quote unquote coffee would revert to its natural gelatinous state. But it was an approximation. He's like, this is not a mouth. It is an approximation of a mouth.
All right. So now that we're done talking about Odo, I think it's time we can give our final thoughts on the movie. I think I
had my weekly derailing. I'm good.
We all, I think, know mine is that I love this movie and it makes me very emotional. David, what are your final thoughts?
This is probably my favorite Star Trek movie. There's been times where I just would put in the DVD and just let it run on the background, and I would, you know, once it was over, I'd loop it over and start it up again. One thing I also wanted to say real quick was great, you know, visual imagery in the movie, like the costumes, the computer effects.
Very good-looking movie, yeah.
Even the bridge consoles, they have a new kind of design, or like they updated it for that. Very cool visual effects, but also I wanted to say, great soundtrack. It's done by Cliff Eidelman. I think it was the only Star Trek soundtrack he's done, and it's very different than a lot of the Star Trek soundtracks because it is heavily Klingon. You get like percussion, you get like, you know, it's just a different feel of a Star Trek soundtrack.
It makes for a really nice variety, doesn't it? Yeah.
It has the opening theme had a very militaristic feel to it, very dark and militaristic, which is what we saw in the film.
And then, like,
very
during
good thematic soundtrack.
During some of the assassination scenes and then the Ruripente scenes, it's very, you know, almost tribal, but it's not just tribal, but it's very interesting sound. And one song in particular includes the Klingon language. There's a song called Ruripente. In the background, when the music is going on, it's going tach pag tach bet, like over and over. And, you know, it's cool that they included the Klingon, but also like references to Shakespeare in that song. So aside from it being one of my favorite movies, and, you know, there's a lot of cool Spock quotes and a lot of great action, cool movie, it is one of my favorite Star Trek soundtracks that I would listen to, you know, put in the CD and just listen to the music. It was really one of my favorites all around.
All right, Grace, what are your final thoughts?
Again, agreeing with David, it's a very good-looking movie. It's a very immersive movie. And it is just one of my favorites also, I got to admit. It's a very cerebral Star Trek movie, which, especially after Star Trek V, is such a nice pace, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I've said it before and I'll say it again. I do love me some Shakespearean acting, and it just gets. I just love it. I'm just getting all the clumps now thinking about how much I like it. And
I just remembered we didn't talk about the brief appearances by Michael Dorn, but also at the beginning.
No, we didn't.
So that's interesting. It was during the next generation, and I also just want to say that at the very beginning of the movie, it says, for Gene Roddenberry. I think this is the first movie after his passing, so that's significant.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Also, on that note, I feel like it's a movie that really incorporates the influence of the current series with the Next Generation really well, and really uses that to its advantage.
Agreed.
Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it.
All right, Sori, final thoughts as our guest?
It needed more cowbell.
That's what you take away from this.
More Klingon opera.
Is there a Klingon cowbell? Is there a way
we
can find the two?
I loved it. It's one of my favorite TOS movie era films. There's so much Klingon in it, which really helped, you know, shape that culture. It set the Klingon Empire on a path that we saw in TNG and DS9. It really set the tone of the race, and I'm still discovering new things every time I watch it. So, you know, it's fabulous. There are little problems here and there, but overall, it's just so much fun, so enjoyable.
Oh, also, can I add one more thing?
Go ahead.
This movie also plays on a lot of Star Trek tropes really well, which makes it just really fun if you're a fan of the original series or a fan of Star Trek in general, because you've got the culture clash thing, which is always a theme in Star Trek that keeps coming back, and you get the kangaroo court scene, which is such a staple of Star Trek, isn't it?
Yep.
It just...
That's a fact.
It's a show. Oh, yeah. I also wanted to mention, there's two different versions of the movie, depending on where you see it, what DVD you have, you know, what copy you have of it. There is the theatrical version, which, you know, was in the theater because it was the theatrical version. Sometimes that's what is available on, you know, Netflix or wherever you might see it. But when the movie first came out, back in the, you know, 80s or whenever, when it was first put out on DVD, they included some extra scenes, and that's where we get, speaking of Odo, we get Rene Auberjonois as,
Colonel West.
Colonel West, there you go, with talking about cleaning the chronometers of, you know, the Klingons. And then that was in the early briefing scene when they're right after Kirk and McCoy are taken to the courtroom or to the, not before the prison, but when they're taken, arrested, you know, Colonel West comes in. He's got a great mustache. He's looking cool. He puts out plans like, here's how we could do a surgical, you know, reconnaissance and go get our people. And then later he comes back around. It was when Michael Dorn is like, this is not Klingon blood. And then they do the Scooby-Doo thing where they pull off the Klingon mask and it's Colonel West. So I just wanted to, you know, give a shout out that the shades of DS9 later, Rene did a great job in that role, even though it was real short and unfortunate that it got cut. So look for that. It was the original DVD release that added those scenes in. And I wanted to also say real quick about the Klingon language. This movie makes good use of the Klingon language. I like how they, not just that they use it, but how it's addressed. There's a couple scenes where they're speaking in Klingon and there's subtitles. And at a key moment, the way they do the pacing and the timing of it, Chang would like go, hey, like with his finger, and then they switch to English. So it was cool that they established that they're talking in Klingon, but then for the audience and for the movie, they, you know, pick a cool time to just switch to English so everybody can follow along. Also in the courtroom scene, Christopher Plummer speaking Klingon, and then they actually show the scene of like the little row of translators that would be speaking like the UN or, you know, whatever, and then it just flips back to Christopher Plummer speaking English. So I just liked how they applied and used and addressed the language issue. Most of the people speaking it are pretty good. There's a couple of the, you know, ancillary Klingons that just going, you know, it's hard to make out what they're trying to say, but Christopher Plummer did a great job with the Klingon language. A couple other people did good too, so I appreciate that.
All right, well, this has been All Things Trek's discussion of Star Trek VI, the final... Oh my god, Star Trek VI,
oh,
the Undiscovered
Corinne.
Country.
Good grief.
I do my best, okay? This has been a very emotional ride for me, all right?
Now,
David, if he's going to be so kind, is going to play Data Logan's... views and thoughts on this movie, which we have as an audio file, and I hope you will join us all next week when we discuss Generations and are joined by Amy from Shoes and Starships.
Thanks for joining us.
David, go ahead and take it away.
Kabla.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's Datalog.
One is my name. The other is not.
10 November 2013. Just wanted to share some thoughts about Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. My favorite Star Trek movie. Starting with pointing out another unimaginative parallel that between the most recent movie, Star Trek Into Darkness, and a previous great Star Trek movie. In both movies, there was a conspiracy within Starfleet that wanted war between the Federation and the Klingons. And both sets of conspirators knew that Kirk was a bit of a hothead and didn't like Klingons. So they put him in a situation where he'd be face-to-face with Klingons and really expected him to lose his cool and shoot. Of course, in the more recent movie, we actually ordered to shoot, so it's a little bit different. In Star Trek VI, the much better movie. He was actually on a mission of peace, but the conspirators knew that he was going to be put into a situation where the people aboard Kronos 1 were mad, they were about to attack, and they really expected Kirk to fire back instead of surrendering. It's interesting how much Valeris really had to do with that setup. I mean, she was the one who recommended the Romulan ale during the dinner, supposedly in order to make the night go more smoothly, but in reality, probably for the exact opposite reason. And then when Kronos 1 was coming around, it was Valeris and Chekhov, too, who were really recommending shields and that they go into an attack posture. It's interesting because, of course, if there had been a shooting war that started right then, I'm betting that Chang would probably expect that he would be on the winning side. And Valeris, who's part of this conspiracy with Chang, maybe she expected to die there. That's quite a bit of dedication. I like that they had a picture of Abraham Lincoln up in the mess hall. It was an allusion to the episode Savage Curtain, where it was established that Abraham Lincoln was one of Kirk's heroes. I like that they split the crew up a little bit, having Sulu off on his own ship. It's funny how they did that in my second favorite Star Trek movie, Star Trek II, where they had Chekhov off on a different ship. This movie's just got a great theme about people, and especially a bit more militaristic people, like Starfleeters, who are learning to get along and live with people that used to be their enemies. Even though the characterization of the evil military Starfleeters was a bit ridiculous at times. Like that woman in the beginning of the movie who says, "Oh, the Klingons are dying out? Well, does that mean we're going to mothball the fleet?" As if Starfleet doesn't do anything else besides protect against Klingons. But the theme there of two enemies learning to live together and even come together in peace, it's really amazing and powerful, well done, and it's all played through the Kirk character. And even Kirk, unable to really understand how history can get past people like him. I love the direction and a lot of the little subtle clues that go into the whodunit of the movie. Like, obviously, there's the clue that Valeris was listening in to Kirk when he was making his log that was later given at his trial. Although the actual words that were spoken in the log that was recorded were different than the one played at his trial, somehow. Continuity error. But there's even subtler hints than that. Even earlier in the movie, in the briefing room, after the briefing's over, and it's just Spock and Kirk in the room, and they're talking about Klingons and everything, and Kirk says that line, "Let them die." It's subtle to notice, but you see in the shadows in the background, there's a woman sitting there, even though the briefing's let out. Everybody else has left the room, except Kirk and Spock, and then this one woman that's sitting in the background. So it makes you wonder later on, when Valeris reveals the fact that she knows Kirk says let them die. Was that how she knew it? Was she the woman sitting in the dark? Or was it a co-conspirator of hers that told her what Kirk had said? I also like the fact that they put clocks on the bridge. It just makes sense that there would be a timepiece. Although I can understand why they don't normally do it, because it's got to be a continuity nightmare to keep all those clocks in sync on every single picture frame that you're doing. And they did a pretty good job of it, really. I think the clocks were only got off by a couple seconds at most. Of course, there were other inconsistencies in the movie, like Viridian patches, never being mentioned before or since. There's a hand phaser that's kept in the galley. A hand phaser that can destroy a pot, but not the contents of a pot. The color of Klingon blood, which here is violet, although it's never been violet before or since. Uhura suddenly can't do a job and doesn't know how to speak Klingon, just to get a laugh. This movie establishes that the Khitomer Accords, which allowed the Federation and the Klingon Empire to become friends and allies, happened decades before and the Enterprise-C was destroyed at Narendra 3, making this movie a little inconsistent with yesterday's Enterprise. And then there's sort of an inconsistency with the TNG episode Loud as a Whisper. That episode established that the mediator Reva was important to the Klingon Federation Accords, although he doesn't appear in this movie. Of course, Curzon Dax was also supposedly important to the Federation Klingon Accords, but that hadn't been established yet because those Deep Space Nine episodes hadn't happened yet, so that's a little more forgivable for the movie. In fact, most all of these inconsistencies are pretty forgivable. The movie's just awesome. Edge of your seat, incredible characterizations of people, and huge sweeping politics, pretty good space battle. But I gotta say, my favorite part of this movie, my favorite of all Star Trek movies, is Spock. I love Spock in this movie. He's just the right blend of logic and emotion and friendship and being a soldier and being a diplomat. Plus, he tends to be a lot less racist than all the other characters in the movie. This is the Spock that knows that logic is the beginning of wisdom, not the end of wisdom. The Spock that's pointing out, well, of course Ezra didn't cry when her father died, because Klingons don't have tear ducts. A moment which I really love in the movie because it challenges your preconceptions about Klingons and reminds you that, oh, by the way, they're aliens. They're different. This is the Spock that saves his friend by coming up with the Viridian Patch idea. This is the Spock that uses that line from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And then also, by the way, announces that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was an ancestor of his. And yes, this is the Spock who was willing to force a mind meld because the situation called for it. Even though, obviously, it's a horrific violation of Valeris's mind and rights. But Spock understood that this is something that had to be done, and only he could do it. He was willing to do the act, and he was willing to live with the guilt that undoubtedly would come because of it. Similar, really, to what Benjamin Sisko had to do in the episode In the Pale Moonlight. As Spock says, I've been dead before. All right, guys, thanks for listening to my comments. Data out.